Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, listeners from around the world. This is episode number 1118, and this is Jason Hartman. Thank you so much for joining me today. I always appreciate having you on the show, as we are going to 5 days a week. 5 days a week. Yes, you have asked for it, and now we are delivering. We were a three-day-a-week show. Hey, back in the old days, we were maybe once a week, if we were lucky, and if you guys were lucky. Sometimes we didn't produce an episode for 2 or 3 weeks. It was terrible. But for many years, we've been producing 3 days a week, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and now we are going to 5 days a week, because we have so many people asking for it and so many people asking questions that we would like to answer on the show. And we've been behind on those, so we're going to get through that backlog. And you can ask your questions or leave your comments or insights or anything you want at jasonhartman.com/ask. jasonhartman.com/ask for any listener feedback or questions. And Adam, welcome. How are you doing today?
I am doing really well. How are you today?
Good to have you back on the show. It is a rainy, gray day in beautiful Florida, here on the Treasure Coast. You know, I didn't know they called where I lived the Treasure Coast until I went to place an ad on Craigslist. And I guess this is referred to as the Treasure Coast here in Florida. So, hey, I'm excited about living in this place.
You're on the Treasure Coast, and I'm in the live music capital of the world. So we got all nicknames all over the place.
That would be Austin, Texas. Hey, keep Austin weird, right?
All the new money is keeping it weird. That's right.
Oh, well, I don't know. I think Austin's getting a lot less weird than it used to be.
Definitely.
I mean, it's getting pretty, you could argue, boring. It's becoming a too much of a tech place. You know, it's not so weird anymore.
Well,
I mean, weird referred to the hippies and all that craziness.
But, well, it's one of those things when you get money coming in from tech companies and people moving from, you know, higher tax states that come in, you know, eventually your property values go up and the weird companies who refuse to conform can't make enough money to stay there. And so a lot of them have gone out of business or moved farther out of town.
Yeah. And it's not just the weird companies, it's the weird people. And when we say weird, we are saying that with affection, you know, the hipsters and all that kind of stuff.
Right? Counterculture.
The counterculture, exactly. The counter-establishment. Okay, Adam, so do we want to, let's start with some listener questions.
All right. First up, we have Gerard Patron, and he wants to know if it is possible, if there's any way in the world, he can sell a property without doing a 1031 exchange and avoid paying capital gains tax.
Not really, no. You can't. Gerard, you're going to have a tax bill if you sell your properties without a 1031 tax deferred exchange. That's just the reality of it. I've actually got some coming up, more on this, more on the opportunity, the overrated opportunity zones. That is one way to potentially do it if you'll wait 10 years. But again, as you know, I think the opportunity zone thing is largely hype. I don't think the tax benefit is that good a deal. I think it's totally overrated. It's being used as a way for people to just be greedy and promote real estate in blighted areas. And look, I could be wrong about this, but I've been researching it like crazy. And I do not want to be the fad guy to jump on the latest fad all the time. Years ago, when we did the Go Zone and we recommended that, that really was an incredible tax opportunity to save on taxes. But the opportunity zones, it doesn't even come close to that. The tax benefit isn't that big a deal. The areas in which you're forced to invest aren't that attractive for the most part. So that's kind of overrated. So Gerard, I went from your question on 1031 exchange and capital gains tax to the opportunity zone, because that is the one way to skirt that issue a little bit, but it's got a zillion conditions lopped onto it. So I don't think it's a very good deal. But the short answer to your question, when you asked it before this opportunity zone stuff was all over the news, no, you got to pay your capital gains. I mean, you know, look, there are a couple things that will nip around the edges. You can do what I believe is called an installment sale trust, okay? And basically that comes down to this. If you sell a property that is highly appreciated and has capital gains tied up in it where you're going to have to pay that tax, you could do an installment sale. And that means you carry paper for the buyer. And if you carry paper for the buyer, it essentially means that you're not selling the property all at once. I mean, you are selling it, but you're not receiving all of the proceeds at once. You're receiving the proceeds over time in the form of a note. And you would pay taxes as you receive proceeds. That's the way the installment sale rules go. By the way, always make the appropriate disclaimer, I am not a tax expert or a legal expert. Check out anything I say, any of the concepts we talk about on the show with the appropriate professional. But you would pay as you go. So you're still paying it, but you pay over time. You pay the tax over time. Now, what some people are out there promoting is this installment sale trust. So you could sell the property and then give the proceeds to the trust. Okay, now this is more complicated, so be sure you get some good tax advice on this, okay? But the concept is like that. You know, you put the property in the trust, then you sell the property, and then the trust receives the proceeds and doles out a small portion of that proceeds to you in little payments over time. So, you know, the concept here is that you don't pay the tax until you receive them, just like on the installment sale. The only distinction is you're using the trust like a third party, almost like a natural person, to dole out payments to you slowly, but you have some degree of control over that trust, okay? So you can do that. You can donate the money to charity and use a vehicle like a CRT, a charitable remainder trust. That one's kind of above my pay grade. I've certainly heard the presentations about it and researched it, but again, you know, it's not my area. So there is your answer. Sorry, I don't have better news for you. Basically, in most normal circumstances, you sell the property, you're going to pay the gain.
Yeah, it sounds like in that situation, there may be ways to avoid the capital gain in some ways, but then you have to ask yourself, I have to tie my money up for a long time to do it. So is it worth the opportunity cost of losing all those years of potential return that I could get on the money in order to invest that way?
Right, exactly. Now, if you use the installment sale trust concept, I'm guessing that you'd probably be able to invest that money within the trust. So the trust could be the vehicle that could, you know, ostensibly buy more real estate, right? But if you're going to buy more real estate, why not just do a 1031 exchange, you know? So, you know, what else do you want to really invest in anyway? Income property works so well. I mean, you know, when under current law, when you die, the basis steps up. So if you're going to pass it down, you know, I don't know Gerard's age, but that's a great opportunity. Yeah, the opportunity is to die. Well, this is a very positive show here, isn't it, folks? Yes, I'm sure you'll be tuning in as often as you can. But dying is one way out of it. You know? So there you go.
They don't call it a death benefit for nothing.
That it is a death benefit. Good one, Adam. That's good. Okay, what else we got?
So Gupta Samir has a question about diversification. And Gupta's question is essentially, would you buy multiple properties in one area and then move to the next market? Or would you buy one property per market and then add? Which diversification strategy do you think is the best? I have my thoughts. I'm curious what your thoughts are as well.
Yeah, Samir, that's a good question. The answer is it depends. Here's what it depends on. It depends how many you're buying, okay? How big a thing you're doing. For example, if you're buying six properties, we used to affectionately call this a six pack, okay? If you're buying six, I think it would probably be wise to buy either two or three in, you know, two each in three markets or three each in two markets to start. And one of the reasons for this is that you will learn more by diversifying and working with different property managers. But if you're going to just buy two properties, for example, initially, I would just buy them both in the same market probably, okay? But if you're buying six, you know, I'd be in two markets and then build to the third market after that. And Adam, I have a feeling I know what your opinion is on this, but go ahead and share it.
So mine is, we buy one at a time. And so my theory was we bought our first couple in the same market. We bought all in Memphis because I didn't want to stretch myself with building two teams at the same time. I wanted to start and build the team that I wanted to have in one city. And once I felt comfortable with that, then I can move on to the next market and build a team there and then proceed that
right.
way.
Right. Now, when you say build a team, I mean, you bought them through our network.
I wanted to build a team. Right. But I wanted to make sure that I understood kind of the rates that homes were selling for, like the pricing of the homes. I wanted to be sure that I found a property manager or myself that I could trust that I felt comfortable with. And I didn't want to have to be doing all of that at one time across two or three different markets. I wanted to feel comfortable in one and then move to the next and then move to the next.
Good point. Good point. I would say that three markets all at once, especially if you are just starting to build your real estate portfolio, that's a little much. But you do get a benefit of working with different people because then you can compare them. It's kind of like when you're young, you know, maybe you move around and you have a couple of different jobs, right? You learn a lot doing that. It's not wise to be inconsistent and, you know, move around too much. But the one benefit of it is you do learn some things, right? And so the same is true of dealing with two different investment property teams in two different areas. Now, the one thing you always have that's consistent is you have us, you know, because it's through our network, but you will be dealing with different local market specialists, different property managers, and, you know, different taxing authorities. So the property taxing authority will be different. The customs in each market might be different. And this is the fragmentation thing I talk about often, you know, when I say embrace the fragmentation, because by and large, that's kept the big institutional investors out of our game. They're here now more than they've ever been. But in terms of the overall market size, there's still a drop in the bucket. You know, even when you talk about huge operations like, you know, Invitation Homes, all these other iBuyers out there, and, you know, these hedge funds and private equity groups, and all of this is still a relatively small thing in the overall scheme of investment real estate. Okay, so hope that makes sense. But you know, try and diversify into two markets if you can. I think that's the way to go. And not everybody buys one at a time like you and Aaron did, Adam. Mm-hmm. Some of them buy several properties at a time. So, you know, I'd see if I could get into at least two markets at first.
All right. Well, those are the listener questions for today.
Okay, well, we got two in. Good. Let's go to some current events. Well, Adam, first, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't just talk before we get to a couple of stories I know you want to cover about the government open up. It's not a shutdown, it's an open up. I guess Trump caved into those evil Democrats. He did for three more weeks. But you know, the thing I was hoping we would realize, look, I'm not in favor of a shutdown because it's chaotic, right? It's obviously inefficient. It costs more money to shut the government down and reopen it than it does to just keep it open, right? It's not a good thing. But philosophically, my hope is and is, that people might come to realize how we could do with a lot less government. If the government shut down long enough for the private sector to come in and fill the void in some of these various services and things that government does, I think it'd be a good thing. And you know, you heard me talk about that NPR story, Adam. I know you probably love NPR, where the woman was complaining about how the USDA was insuring her mortgage and she couldn't close on her house. And she had to move back in with her parents for a couple of weeks because, you know, the government shut down, right? But what the heck is the USDA doing insuring mortgages anyway? I mean, This is nuts. This causes massive distortions in the market for the government to be involved in all this crap. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, all of it just needs to go. But it's probably not going to happen. So,
oh, it's definitely not going anywhere.
But it's a fantasy.
I think you and I have different takes on the rationality of markets as well. So I don't think, I think the government needs to be involved in some extent to those things, because I don't think that the market itself, well, first off, you and I both agree, there is no such thing as a free market. All markets are controlled in some way. And I think that the government, there are some things that it probably shouldn't be in. Like, I agree the USDA probably shouldn't be insuring mortgages. But the mortgage industry, the government being there, helps with the investing, I think. I think it helps having the government in there as well as your private lenders. Because the government provides a baseline. And so people know, hey, we are competing against it. I mean, you look at Medicare. The Medicare rates are what all of the insurance companies pay off of anyway. I mean,
right,
the government
but,
is
but
able
then you
to
have massive Medicare fraud, you know, and why are they paying off the Medicare rates? I mean, who says that's the right rate? Shouldn't the market just determine the rate over time? Shouldn't everybody just figure out what to charge for everything? I mean,
that's just negotiating, though. The government's able to negotiate better rates because they're a larger entity.
Oh, that's hilarious. You actually think the government negotiates better rates on anything?
I guarantee you the lowest price you can find is your Medicare price because the government has negotiated the price of it.
Oh, my God, Adam. Okay, we don't have time for this argument, but let me tell you something. The government is always the willing loser in any transaction, in any deal. Where there are multiple parties, the government is always the willing loser, okay? The government massively overpays for stuff all the time. Do you know, I have friends that own businesses, and they just can't wait to get a juicy government contract and suck off the teat of the government, right? Because it's just so lucrative. These companies with these government contracts, they just pillage. And then it comes time for the budget. And like I have a friend that sells computers to the government, right? And every year, business just booms. I think it's in like September or something like that. Because
probably that's the start of the new fiscal year.
Right, because all these departments of the government have to use their whole budget. So they just buy a bunch of crap they don't even need. I mean, look, we could go on and on for days about
I agree that they're not always the best, but in healthcare, they are. They get the best rate in healthcare.
Better than, how do you know? Compared to what? How do you
because
know?
Because all of the insurance companies, if they could negotiate better rates and make a better profit margin, they would. But they all base it, if you look at your bills, if you compare it, everything is based off of Medicare rates.
The idea that you think the Medicare rate is the best rate is, I don't know.
Tell me then, why wouldn't Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna or any of those other ones work out a better rate with the companies than the Medicare rate if they could?
Maybe it's because the provider of the healthcare just basically will ignore them if they negotiate a better rate. Maybe the government has put in a false floor saying that basically, you know, now they won't take Blue Cross's business. They won't take their customers if they don't pay the Medicare rate, the maybe artificially high Medicare rate. You know, do you know what was
I'm not going down that conspiracy rabbit hole.
Yeah. Oh, conspiracy. That's not a conspiracy. That's just market forces.
You're talking about price fixing with the government.
What do you mean?
You're talking about the government basically colluding with these companies to keep their prices that way.
No. I didn't say that at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is okay, so look, you've got these different parties in the transaction. You've got the provider of the healthcare, right? The doctor's office, right? Or the hospital, right? Then you've got Medicare that pays X amount for X procedure, right? Then you've got these private insurance companies that also want to get the best rate. And so they might be able to negotiate a better rate with the healthcare provider, the doctor or the hospital. But if they do, then those providers of healthcare may not take their business, because why would they? Now that you've got Medicare there and these millions of people using Medicare, they'll just say, well, why should we take Blue Cross's customers? We're going to turn them down because we can get more on the government price list. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying there's a conspiracy at all. I'm just saying there's market forces. And the government creates a distortion in the market always because they're a big spender. They come in and throw money around, and they distort marketplaces. See, we don't know what the real rate should be.
If your scenario was true, then it would actually be opposite of the way it works now, because right now doctors aren't taking Medicare, but do take private insurance.
Well, then the private insurance must be actually paying more, or maybe they're not paying more, but they're just less bureaucratic and easier to deal with. Maybe. That's probably the reason. I mean, look, I'm not a healthcare expert. I'm just saying I am a market expert, though. I definitely understand how marketplaces work and the dynamics of them. And I can tell you that in business, many times, as Sarah likes to say, we're going to have Sarah back on the show soon. She hasn't been on in a while. She takes the old saying, shoot yourself in the foot. And she says, don't shoot yourself in the shoe. And, you know, a lot of times in business, I've shot myself in the shoe because I will go and be a really good negotiator, and then the vendor will just kind of fizzle out because they're not really that motivated to provide whatever they were providing because the deal wasn't that good for them. You know, they got people that are willing to pay more. And hey, more power to them. I'm a capitalist, so I don't care. But, you know, these are the pressures of the marketplace, and they're good pressures. Things work themselves out. It's the invisible hand, as Adam Smith said in 1776.
I was actually listening to a podcast about Adam Smith when I was working out the other day. I might have been the only one in the gym listening to one about that, but it was an interesting one.
Maybe Adam Smith, but, you know, I listen to audiobooks and podcasts at the gym. So, yeah, very motivating. Well,
do you want to talk about one of the greatest deal makers of all time?
I do. That's Warren Buffett, right?
Yes, sir. Now, there was an article that came out recently that talks about Buffett came out and said, really successful people say no to almost everything. And we were looking at this and thinking that it applies a whole lot to real estate investing. And both Gates and Buffett broke everything down. And they said if they were sitting around the table and they could share the most important factor to their success in one word, what would it be? And the one word that both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett said was focus.
Yeah, right. I agree. Look, a very popular book has been The One Thing, right? And, you know, I think that book's kind of overrated, honestly. I mean, it's good, but, you know, it's just not that complicated, right? This is a pretty simple thing. I think it's very true, you know. As humans, we always have shiny object syndrome, as they call it, right? What is the hot investment of the day? And this must be just terrible for people in the stock market world, for stock investors, because there's always a new shiny deal many times a day. All you have to do is turn on CNBC and you'll be tempted constantly.
Oh yeah.
But with real estate, it happens too. You know, there are this deal and that deal, and that Russian Olympian figure skater, I can't remember her name, but she had that great quote. She says, you know, the key to success is to follow without halt, one aim, right? You know, to just do one thing really, really well. And I think that is true. You know, look at people in real estate investing. They have problems from time to time. They get discouraged. You know, things don't work out. They have to evict a tenant. The tenant trashed their house. Fine. That all happens, right? That's part of your college degree in real estate investing. It's just going to happen, right? But we all know, everybody listening knows, that income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world. There are mountains and mountains of evidence that it works. Now, granted, someone listening individually may have had a struggle with something, but over time, it works, okay? We all know that. We really do. So why not just follow that path and stick to that path? Because it is the ultimate path. You know, there's really only three things I invest in: my own businesses, income properties, and financing income properties. That's it. You know, those three things, right? And my own business, my main own business, happens to be centered around real estate investing. The real estate investments themselves are definitely centered around real estate investing. And the financing for those real estate deals is also centered around real estate investing. But I'm diversified geographically. So I'm focused in the asset class, but diversified geographically. I'm not saying I'm great at this focus thing, but I do agree that it's a great thing to do, is to just get on that assembly line and keep it going. And I'll tell you, one thing happens in our business constantly, Adam, And, you know, you've probably seen this already, you know, for the few years you've been working with us, but people are always asking, you know, hey, you know, what about triple net leases? You know, do you have any retail properties? What about this and that and the other thing? How about this? There's this office building I want to buy, you know, can you help me with that? No, we can't. You know, it's maybe some of the listeners who are like my age remember this funny skit on Saturday Night Live, where they're in the restaurant and they only have one thing. They go, you know, a guy says, I'll have a hamburger. And he says, no hamburger, cheeseburger. and he says, I'll have a hamburger and a Coke. No hamburger, cheeseburger, no Coke, Pepsi. and they just do this one thing over and over, right? And it's really boring. And if you look at that, we see it in our world too. And in the hamburger concept, look at a company like In-N-Out Burger. Look at how successful that company is. It's probably the most successful burger, fast food burger place, okay, for sure. And it's not all over the country, or certainly not all over the world.
I think McDonald's might disagree with you on that one.
Well, no. In-N-Out is... See, I'm not defining success by size. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. I'm just defining it by, like, best company to work for, best food, best prices. When you go in there, that people treat you well. I mean, look, I think Southwest is like the best airline, okay? But they're not the biggest, right? So, gotcha. So that's just my definition of best, okay? So In-N-Out Burger, very simple, small menu, right? You go to McDonald's or, you know, any other fast food place, and you've got these ridiculous menus, like with all of these items, it's too complicated. And that must just weigh on the efficiency of the enterprise, you know, to have that kind of complexity in your menu. But the funny thing is, both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, as we're talking about that article, Warren Buffett is obviously in a zillion businesses, right? Mm-hmm. And Bill Gates has a zillion products, right? Or Microsoft did one under the auspices of his leadership. So I don't know.
But he has five strategies that are put forward in this article. And strategy number one is killing busy work and not chasing the shiny stuff. Mm-hmm. Strategy number two is only work with people you could see yourself working with forever. Mm-hmm. Number three is keeping things simple. Mm-hmm. Four is focusing on a few high quality bets. So as you know, I think everybody knows, Buffett only invests in 1 to 3 things a year.
Yeah, and Buffett has one definite definable investing strategy too.
And that's number five, focus on long-term bets.
Yeah. But not only that, it's that he has a real philosophy. That's what I love about Buffett, even though I think he's a hypocrite a lot of the times. And, you know, I don't like Wall Street. But I do love his value investing philosophy. I very much apply that to real estate. So, yeah, that's good. Good stuff, Adam. That's good.
In terms of working with people you could see yourself working with forever, that's vetting your vendors.
Yeah.
You know, make sure you're buying from the people you trust, because that way, and the... He does very little negotiating from what I've read. Whenever he purchases a company, he sees it. He knows the price that he wants. He trusts the people that he's working with. He says, I'll pay you this. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a yes or no thing. And I mean, that's a good thing. We should all in our investments go in knowing what it's worth and holding firm to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That is a very good point. And the idea that Buffett not negotiating very much is kind of interesting to me, because he never worries too much about, is it a good deal? Mm-hmm. You know, like, did I buy it below market? What he looks for is the future. And, you know, when we talk about market dynamics, as we're talking about healthcare and Adam Smith and all that kind of stuff, I think that's really important. You know, pretty much every deal is a good deal in the rearview mirror. You know, you just buy it and wait a little bit, and the deal looks really good, okay, when you let a little time pass. But at the time, it usually seems like you're just paying full retail, and sometimes you even feel like you overpaid. And that may well be true. I mean, look at these big tech deals, right? I thought when Google bought YouTube, I thought they must be nuts. I thought they were out of their mind. But that turned out to be underpriced, right, in the rearview mirror. When Facebook bought Instagram, I thought they were crazy. $1 billion for Instagram when it's just got, what, 30 employees or something, this little company, how can that be worth $1 billion? They must be smoking crack, as the saying goes, right? And apparently I was wrong, okay? That was a great deal for them. You know, with WhatsApp, they paid $19 billion for WhatsApp, and apparently that was a great deal too. So these deals seem expensive sometimes, but when you really understand the value of a durable asset like income property, they're all a bargain in the rearview mirror. You know, you just got to let a little time pass, you know, and then it just pains me, the deal maker mentality that, oh, you know, the guy wouldn't give me a good enough deal, or these houses are too overpriced. And, you know, then you wait 3 years and they're saying shoulda, coulda, woulda. I wish I would have bought everything I could have seen, you know, or I saw, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's like you mentioned in a podcast not that long ago about leaving meat on the bone. I mean, you have to look at, go into it knowing, you know what, I want a fair price for me, but I'm not trying to mess up the person who's selling to me.
Right.
You know, I want them to make a living too. I want them to be able to rehab more properties so that I can buy more from them. You know, so everybody needs to walk away happy.
Yeah. You know who really kind of showed me that? He didn't teach it to me. He showed me through his actions. And that was, he's been on the show before, but my old friend Jeff Myers, who, when I acquired him as a client back in, like 1989, he was, you know, one of my big first early clients. And I sold five of his properties for him in Irvine and Laguna Niguel and those areas of Orange County, California. You know, Jeff did not haggle very much. He was the seller and he was just like, just get these properties out the door. I want to buy other properties. You know, he always left some meat on the bone for the next guy. You know, it's like he really didn't waste a lot of time agonizing about things. And, you know, I think that's a good quality. I think you're right. Yeah. Good point. Good point. Okay, Adam, we better wrap it up, right?
I think so. I think we've rambled for a little while.
Okay, we sure have. Well, hey, folks, I hope you found this episode valuable. We will be back tomorrow. Yes, 5 days a week now, folks, 5 days a week. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode. Until then, happy investing. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.